Good morning, everyone. My name is Angie, and I'll be reading from 2 Samuel chapter 5, verses 1 to 25. Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "Behold, we are your bone and flesh. In times past, when Saul was king over us, it was you who led out and brought in Israel. And the Lord said to you, 'You shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over Israel.' So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 40 years. At Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and at Jerusalem, he reigned over all Israel and Judah 33 years. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who said to David, 'You will not come in here, but the blind and lame will ward you off,' thinking, 'David cannot come in here.' Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is, the city of David. And David said on that day, 'Whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him get up the water shaft to attack the lame and the blind, who are hated by David's soul.' Therefore it is said, 'The blind and the lame shall not come into the house.' And David lived in the stronghold and called it the city of David. And David built the city all around from the Milo inward. And David became greater and greater, for the Lord, the God of hosts, was with him. And Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David and cedar trees, also carpenters and masons who built David a house. And David knew that the Lord had established him a king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. And David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem after he came from Hebron, and more sons and daughters were born to David. And these are the names of those who were born to him in Jerusalem: Shemua, Shobab, Nathan, Solomon, Ibhar, Elishua, Napheg, Japhiah, Elishama, Eliada, and Eliphelet. When the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to search for David. But David heard of it and went down to the stronghold. Now the Philistines had come and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. And David inquired of the Lord, 'Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand?' And the Lord said to David, 'Go up, for I will certainly give the Philistines into your hand.' And David came to Baal-perazim, and David defeated them there. And he said, 'The Lord has broken through my enemies before me like a breaking flood.' Therefore, the name of that place is called Baal-perazim. And the Philistines left their idols there, and David and his men carried them away. And the Philistines came up yet again and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. And when David inquired of the Lord, he said, 'You shall not go up. Go around to their rear and come against them opposite the balsam trees. And when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then rouse yourself, for then the Lord has gone out before you to strike down the army of the Philistines.' And David did as the Lord commanded him and struck down the Philistines from Geba to Gezer." These are the true words of the living God.
Thank you so much, Angie, for reading that for us so well. Well, good morning again. I want to share something about my background. I come from South Africa, if you don't know. Born in 1976. And so that put me at age 17 in April of 1994. And that was the moment of democracy coming to South Africa for the first time. And so historically, if you don't know much about the history of South Africa, there was a small minority, funny enough, minority is always small, which dominated the majority for centuries upon centuries. And the people of South Africa, the majority, were ruthlessly oppressed and unable to rise up. And there was always this hope, there was always this promise, can I say, of that one day freedom would come. And generation after generation, it failed to come. And then one day, Things changed. I won't go into all the politics behind that, but freedom came to the majority of South Africans. And on the 27th of April was the first democratically held election day. At long last, the promise had come to be realized. And my memory of it, I was only 17 at the time, but my memory of it was seeing people queuing up for the polling booths for literally kilometers. They'd wait, they'd walk for kilometers, and then they'd be in these queues, which were just snaking around the corner. Everyone coming to the big day at long last to cast their vote and to be free. So I begin with that story because that's something of what's going on in this passage today. God has promised the king. And we've gone through chapter after chapter after chapter of being under bad kings. And then today is the moment when God's king comes to the throne. And all those years of waiting are finally put to bed. And so the big idea today is it's a high water mark in the story of Samuel and in this book. And the big idea is this, is that God's long-awaited promise that David will be king over Israel is number one, fulfilled, and then number two, emphatically confirmed. It's fulfilled, and then it's confirmed. It's fulfilled by God, and then he confirms it with a great deal of power. So, using those two words, fulfilled and confirmed, I want to make 4 points today. The first one is this, promises fulfilled. We start off looking at how the promises, plural, are fulfilled. Not only are they fulfilled, point number two, but having been fulfilled, then they are confirmed. Promises fulfilled, promises confirmed. And then if we can take it to one next level and say this, that these promises that are not only fulfilled and confirmed, actually in and of themselves are the promise of another king to come. So the promise just didn't end there. It was actually a promise that led to another promise of Jesus who was to come. And then finally, I want us to land on this idea that looking at God in action and seeing promises fulfilled and then emphatically confirmed, we need to know that there is an inevitability of God reigning as king. The inevitability of God reigning as king. Okay, well, let's get into the first point, which is this, that the promises of God become fulfilled in this chapter. The promises of God become fulfilled in this chapter. And you may not know it, but there are at least two promises that are fulfilled. So we'll deal with the easiest one first, or the most obvious, and that is the promise of David to become king. We don't know exactly, but we think that it took about 15 years, as it were, for this promise to be fulfilled. It took 15 years in the making. And I'm going to just give us a quick recap over some of the high points of this promise being made in the book of Samuel. 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel are historically one book, so we're just going to tie them together, and we're going to make a quick trip into 1 Samuel. And in chapter 13, after Saul is made king, we read this, and I'm just going to read it quickly. We have been over this terrain in the past, so you're probably familiar if you've been coming for some time to this church. But now Saul's kingdom shall not continue, says God. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people. So that's the promise, and God's got David in mind, that David is going to take over from Saul. And then one thing leads to another, and then the prophet Samuel anoints David, and this is in chapter 16. And Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed David in the midst of his brothers. And this is when you anoint someone, for those of you who are new, that is the mark and the sign that you are signified to become the king. So this anointing is very powerful. It's the promise that David, you are going to be the king. And then the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon David in that moment. So the promise is made way back in chapter 16. David is maybe 13, 14, somewhere around there, who can say? One thing leads to another, and it becomes universally known that David is the king to be. He is the king to come, and it's not Saul. In fact, it's so well known that even Saul himself begins to accept and concede that David is going to be the king to be. Again, this is all part of God making his promise. So Saul himself says this in chapter 24, "And now behold, I, Saul, know that you, David, shall surely be king," says Saul, "and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand." So there's the promise. But then we go through chapter after chapter after chapter of David not being king. Until finally we read here in verse 1 and 2, then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron. All the tribes of Israel, I want us to notice. All the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "Behold, we are your bone and flesh. In times past when Saul was king over us, it was you, David, who led out and brought in Israel. And the Lord said to you," so again, this is the people of Israel now repeating the promise. That what did the Lord say? The Lord said, "You, David, shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over Israel." So there's universal acceptance. Everyone knows, David, in the past you led the armies. You were the guy. We all knew that God's real plan was that David was going to be king. But we had to live through the Saul era. And now the day has finally come. Verse 3, so all the elders of Israel came to the king, that's David, at Hebron. And King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord. And they anointed David king over Israel. And so finally this promise comes to fulfillment. And that's point number one, promise fulfilled. Promise fulfilled. And I want you to notice this idea of a covenant. You might have no exposure to Christianity and have no idea what a covenant is. A covenant is this agreement. It's stronger than a promise. It's this binding agreement between a strong person and a weaker person. And the obligations that both sides have to fulfill, and the stronger person is going to look after the weaker person. And that is the message of Christianity, that God the King wants to make a covenant with you. And he wants to look after you, and he's going to make it in Christ. And here we see a picture of that, where David is acting like Jesus, making a covenant with people. This binding agreement. There are obligations. In Christ, Christ fulfilled those obligations. He performed our part for us, which is amazing. And he's going to fulfill God's part for us as well, which is doubly amazing. And so that's Christianity, this covenant where we are secure and bonded and bound into. And here we have a picture of a king making a covenant with people. David is this picture of Jesus. But superficially, the promise of David being king is being fulfilled right before our eyes. Okay, there's a second promise, which you may not have picked up on. And this is a promise. It wasn't 15 years in the making. It was 800 years in the making. And this was a promise initially given to Abraham. Way, way, way back at the beginning of the Bible. And a promise that was given to Abraham, and we can have this verse on the screen, is that Abraham, people after him, are going to possess the land of Israel, where this drama is taking place in 2 Samuel chapter 5. And one of the promises given to Abraham 800 years before this is that Abraham's descendants to come were going to conquer the land, and they were going to knock out six tribes. And the sixth tribe on the list are the Jebusites. Fast forward 800 years to 2 Samuel chapter 5, and we see the Jebusites are the sixth tribe which hasn't yet been knocked out or conquered. There's something going on there. All the other tribes did get conquered, and the Israelites have taken over this whole territory, but it's like an island in the middle of the territory of Israel, which is not yet conquered, the Jebusites. That's a promise not fulfilled. The promise was also given to Moses in the burning bush. Again, apologies if you are new to Christianity, but there's a famous story of Moses meeting God in the burning bush. And one of those promises, building on the promise to Abraham, is, hey, Moses, your descendants are going to conquer the people of the Jebusites. And here we see this promise now, for some reason, it wasn't fulfilled for 800 years. But simultaneously with David ascending to the throne, we read here that in verse 6, that this promise gets fulfilled. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who said to David, "You will not come in here." And then they mock him and they say, "The blind and the lame will ward you off. We have been here for at least 800 years. We're unconquerable. All the other nations, they got wiped out. But because we're in Jerusalem, the city which has got fortifications and natural defenses, no one has taken us out. And even if we had an army of blind and lame people, you couldn't even beat us." That's what they're saying. However, If God promises, God will fulfill. And the time and the date and the place came for God to fulfill this promise. Verse 7, nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion. That is the city of David. And David said, in fact, we can skip verse 8, verse 9. And David lived in the stronghold and called it the city of David. And Jerusalem now becomes the capital. It becomes the city of David, or Zion. These are other names known for the city. And David built the city all around from the Millo inward. Promise number 2. This is a great location for David's new capital. It's not so far in the south where he was reigning over Judah. It's not so far in the north that the people in Judah feel forgotten. It's in the middle. And this is David's new territory. And it becomes the most significant city in the Bible, the city of Jerusalem. Okay, 2 promises made by God. 2 out of 2. 2 promises fulfilled by God. Some of them hundreds of years in the making. And they're happening at the same time. And this is God's way of saying to us, and I put it like this, that he is a promise keeper. What are we taking away from this passage? First of all, is that God makes promises, but more importantly, he keeps promises. God is a promise keeper. What he has promised, that will he do. Especially when the promise is about his king. And so I want you to be encouraged today to look to our God who keeps his promises. He is a promise keeper. And all the promises in Christ, he will keep to you and to his people. Okay, promises fulfilled. Next point is not only are they fulfilled, but then they are demonstrated. They are emphatically confirmed to be fulfilled. And here I want to demonstrate this with a quick story again of my background of driving on South African roads. When I was a student, I had this old car. It was very slow. And we used to go on trips. And South Africa is very hilly country in places. And often the roads are single lane and it's quite hard to overtake. And the worst thing you could do would be caught behind a 1980s model VW Beetle. Okay, these things were built like a tank. I don't know what material they put into it, but they were so heavy. And they were terribly slow on the uphill. And it was just very hard to nip around, especially in my old battered car, to overtake these VWs. And you were just hoping for the top of the hill, and then you would take them on the downhill. Unfortunately, when they got to the top of the hill, they were so heavy, momentum was just on their side. And then they would just whisk right out of sight. So you could just never overtake these guys. Now, that is a picture of what's going on here. It seems to take forever to get David to the top of the hill. But now that he's crowned, there's just this force of momentum behind him. And the writer is trying to show us in this passage of, yes, he's crowned, but now just look at how the kingdom expands under him. Not only are the promises fulfilled, not only did he summit to become king, but now there's this force that comes with him. There's this confirmation of the promises. And he puts it succinctly in verse 10, David, now that he's crowned, became greater and greater. For the Lord, the God of hosts, the God of the armies of heaven, the angelic armies, was with him. God promised David would be king, and now that he has made him king, he is with him, going to back him to the hilt. And David becomes more and more powerful because it's God not only fulfilling his promises, but emphatically confirming them. And we see this role reversal where in the past, David was begging to be accommodated by Philistine kings. But here we see the opposite happening. David is now king, and foreign kings are coming to David to court him, to curry favor with David. And so suddenly the shoe is on the other foot. David is now the new kid on the block, and everyone wants his ear and attention. And we have Hiram in verse 11, the king of Tyre, foreign nation, sending messengers to David. Not only that, but he's sending him, he's gifting him these cedar logs, which are these huge trees, the biggest trees in the Bible, to use to build things. He also sends him skilled craftsmen and masons, and he throws in a free house for David. Verse 12, and David knew that the Lord had established him king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. It's a sign. David's my king. And this kingdom is going to expand. David is going to become more and more powerful. Foreign kings are going to honor him. David's star is on the rise. God is with him. God is for him. It's all about the fact that God is backing David and emphatically confirming this kingdom. But not only is he getting adulation and celebration from the kings of the area, but then David's territory, his forcefulness against his enemies begins to kick in as well. And here David is the guy who was against Goliath and the Philistines. The Philistines have been the menace in the neighborhood for many decades. And now suddenly we see the Philistines really being put to the sword. Twice in this passage. Again, radical confirmation of David as the king. And we read about the rout of the Philistines here. And this is in verse 17 and 18. Battle number one, part one. When the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, all the Philistines, so they get their whole team, the whole force, went up to search for David. But David heard of it and went down to the stronghold. Now the Philistines had come and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. That's where they camped. Jump to verse 20. And David came to Baal-perazim. That's a place which got named after this battle. And David defeated them there. And he said, "The Lord has broken through my enemies before me like a breaking flood." Therefore, the name of that place is called Baal-perazim. Now, Baal-perazim in layman's terms means God smashed them. So that's how you remember Baal-perazim. God whacked them. He wiped them out. He hit them hard. It was like this flood which just broke out and destroyed everything in its path. And we're going to name this place in honor of this victory that God has done. Again, it's confirmation by God. It's David winning, but it's not David winning. It's God, because God is behind David. God is confirming David as his king. You see, God can make promises. He can keep them, and then he can confirm them and continue to establish them, because he is a promise keeper. And just to convince you twice, the writer says, well, let me tell you part two, because the Philistines, bless them, weren't put off, and so they came back. This is in verse 22, for their second thrashing. Verse 22, and the Philistines came up yet again and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. It's the same valley. They come back a second time. And this is just God's way of proving and establishing, no, David's my guy, and you're not going to get in his way, and I'm going to radically expand his power and his influence. Verse 25, and David did as the Lord commanded and struck down the Philistines from Geba to Giza. And that's a big swath of land which the kingdom has now pushed these Philistines out. And we don't hear much more about the Philistines for a couple of chapters, which is good news. God promises. Point number one, God fulfills. Not only does he fulfill point number two, but God confirms his promises. And so to summarize it, I put it like this. God's kingdom expands. God's kingdom breaks out against God's enemies. How is this encouraging to you? Well, God is one who keeps his promises. Not only that, but this is a God who is all-powerful, and he brings his kingdom victoriously against enemies as well. Well, all of this, these two points, God's promises are fulfilled, God's promises are confirmed, I want to say, is actually a promise in and of itself. Because point number three is this. Promises fulfilled and confirmed actually promise another king. You see, this is a great story. It's a wonderful story about David being on top of things and God using him in a powerful way. But this is, what, call it 3,000 years ago. Is that all there is to the story? Unfortunately not, because here we see David acting as a type of Christ, being a foreshadowing of a king to come. Because if we're honest, we read this story, and yes, David is doing great stuff, and he's smiting the Philistines, but we still get this feeling that he's just not the perfect king. Because there's a little inconvenient detail right in the middle in verse 13 and 16. He just can't keep himself away from the woman, can he? Verse 13. And David took more concubines and wives. And you're thinking to yourself, dude, don't do it. You're letting the team down here. We've already discussed this last week in chapter 3 about how he took more and more and more wives. And that was an act of insecurity. But now it's like, no, you've got the kingdom. You really don't need more wives. And then it's like, it's not even wives. It's now like non-married women, concubines. It's like, oh, come on. There's just too much flesh there. There's just too much weakness. There's just too much frailty in this king. It's like, come on. And again, don't you love the fact that the Bible is so honest? We should be honest about our sin. It's another takeaway for us this morning. We love to just project the best part of us. We love to omit verse 13 to 16. After he came from Hebron, more sons and daughters were born to David, and these are the names of those who were born to him in Jerusalem. And we have this long list. We're not moralized about this, but we're kind of wincing a little bit, grimacing, like, ah, David, really? Do you have to do this? And then we read the name Solomon, and we like, ah, Solomon, ouch, that really hurts. And again, if you're new to Christianity, Solomon is one of the biggest scandals in the Bible. Because David stole another man's wife and produced Solomon the child. It's really not a kosher story. It's not a good one. But here it is in all its honesty. And the Bible's giving us a hint. Don't worry, we'll get to that in a few more chapters. So keep coming back to church. You'll hear about it in the future. But there's this weakness to Solomon, at least to David. We also get the sense that there's a king bigger than the king in this story. Because the king seems to be taking orders from someone else. And here we have two of my favorite verses in the Bible. Verse 19, David inquired of the Lord. So David is not at the apex of the pyramid here. David is taking his orders from someone else. David is inquiring of a superior authority about what he should do. Now David inquired of the Lord, verse 19, shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand? He's humble. He's acknowledging that the true king, God, Yahweh, should be the one calling the shots here. We get a sense that David is not the ultimate king here. And then the Lord said, go up, for I will certainly give the Philistines into your hand. What about verse 23? Second time, second battle. And when David inquired of the Lord, he said, so he inquires again. And again, God gives him his marching orders. You shall not go up, but go around to their rear and come against them opposite the balsam trees. And then we get this majestic verse in 24. And again, this is all part of the point that David is not the ultimate king here. We get this suggestion, this hint in the story. It's more than a hint. It's an observation, direct observation, that there's a king bigger than the king. And that king is the promised king to come. Verse 24, and when you hear the sound of marching on the tops of the balsam trees, then rouse yourself. For then the Lord has gone out before you to strike down the army of the Philistines. David has to wait for the Lord to ride out in front of him. David is not the ultimate king here. He's a weak man. He's a king under a king. And all of this, again, if we look at the story holistically, all of this is suggestive. It's a promise of a king to come. A true king. A perfect king. A human king, but a human king without flaws, without weaknesses. A human king who is truly the king in an ultimate sense. And so, let's do a quick summary. In David, God promises a better and more perfect king to come, Jesus. This king will be the true anointed one, And to remind you, anointed is Messiah. It gets translated into Greek as Christos, which becomes the name of Christ. And so when the king is anointed, it's this direct hint or connection to Christ the King, the anointed one, the King. And so in David, we see this type or this foreshadowing of Christ, the true anointed who is to come. Not only that, going back to the beginning, verse 2 or verse 1 was it? The king will be a shepherd and he will be a prince. That's how Jesus is described. He's the shepherd of his people. But he's not just a shepherd, he's also a prince, he's a ruler, he's a leader. It was one of the first prophecies about him. And the Magi, you remember the Christmas story? They quote an old text from the Old Testament about this king is going to be a shepherd and a ruler and a prince. This is Jesus that's being spoken of here. This king will bring a true kingdom that expands of the influence of his government. The government will be on his shoulders. He will enlarge the nation. The increase of his kingdom, there will be no end. It's one of the most famous prophecies about King Jesus to come. His kingdom is expanding. We just get a taste of it with the Philistines getting pushed back over the borders, back into their own land. The kingdom expanding, the true king. Well, when the spiritual kingdom comes, the real kingdom, it's going to push everything back. This is a mighty king who has promised to come. This king will break out against and crush his enemies, especially sin. This is a king who Baal Perazim, the Lord smashed them. This is a king who is going to shatter the power of the greatest enemy, which is sin. And this is Jesus, who is going to come as a man, who is going to live perfectly the obligations of the covenant. He's going to live a righteous life. He's going to be human like you and I, except that he never sinned. He's going to go to the cross. He's going to pay for the sin and the penalty that should be yours. And then because he is indomitable, which is a big word to say he is undefeated, you cannot dominate him. Nothing can get this king down. He will rise again from the dead. He will crush death and sin under his feet. His kingdom is going to expand. It's not even governed by time or place because it's going to be an eternal kingdom that he's going to bring and usher in for those that are in him, for those that have accepted him, for those who have repented and in faith received this true king and this new king. And to remind you, he has promised this King Jesus. He has fulfilled it and he will confirm and validate and fulfill his every promise in Christ. And if you are in him, you are in a kingdom that is expanding and that will never, ever lose. God always wins. So the fourth point, which is mercifully the shortest, is this. Given the fact that God's promises are fulfilled and confirmed, can you not see the inevitability of God reigning as king? The big point of today is that God as king will reign. There is an inevitability about it. He is demonstrating this in the story of David. But the story behind the story is that God, the true king, is going to reign. And in this world, that's hard to see because we see so much darkness and brokenness and pain and hurt. And our experience is not necessarily that it looks like utopia and God is really reigning spectacularly here and his kingdom is expanding at every moment. It feels like the opposite. The kingdom is getting shrunk. And God's on the back foot. And why are we all suffering down here? We can feel like that. But the reality is that there is a day coming when he is going to destroy all his enemies, all sin, all death, all pain, all suffering, all hurt, all brokenness, and he is going to reign spectacularly. That one is a racing guarantee. It is a certainty. It might take many years to get there, but we have seen today that if he promises, he will keep his promise and he will confirm it. You need to hear that there is this inevitability about God reigning over everything. That's the big message of this story. Christ's kingdom has come, and yet it is to come. There is a day when he is going to rule. And the prophet Isaiah talks about this. In the new dispensation, after death, after this world ends, God is going to reign from a symbolic Zion, a symbolic Jerusalem. He's going to reign over everything. And so my question to you, and this is a direct question to folks who are not yet in the kingdom, who are technically enemies of this kingdom, my question to you is this. Are you an enemy resisting the inevitability of God's kingdom? You've got a chance to go to Hebron and to make Jesus your king. And that's a gracious offer given to you by Jesus, the king. Won't you accept his invitation into his kingdom? He's offering it to you graciously at cost of himself. His kingdom, it will inevitably come, and you will have to face him one day when you die. Don't resist him, because you are resisting the inevitable. Okay, that's my first question to those who are not yet in the kingdom. My second question to those who are in the kingdom, Christians. You remember how twice David fought the Philistines? Twice it was in the battle, at least the valley of Rephaim, same spot. And you remember how twice David inquired of the Lord? He didn't go, Valley of Rephaim, part two. I know how to do this one. Got it. Don't need you in this one. I know the plan. We just go straight at them. It'll work. Has to. No. Twice, David inquired of the Lord. He didn't just assume, I know what I'm doing. I'm in charge of my life. I'm on top of things. It's all about number one. Don't need you, God. I've got this one figured out. Just make me look good. No. He humbled himself before God. So are you someone in the kingdom? Are you an inquirer of the Lord or not? Or are you the one who calls all the shots, makes all the decisions? Are you the one who decides what battles you're going to fight and where and how? So here's my formal question to you. Do you effectively resist the king by making your own decisions as if you were the king? And then my third and final question. And this one is aimed at the leaders of this church, but you're all welcome to overhear my question to the leaders. Isn't it amazing that David waited? Well, this is how God's plan was. David, yes, you're the human in charge down here, but I'm really in charge of this whole thing. I'm the Lord of hosts. I'm the Lord of the armies. You need to wait for me. And when you hear the sound of me marching out in the top of the balsam trees, that's when you move. That's a model of leadership where the leaders follow the true leader, who is God. And so my question to you, thanks Marcus, are we okay with simple church where the leaders are not the ultimate leaders, but lead by waiting on the Lord to lead us out of the balsams? I find that's a question aimed straight at me. Can we pray?